And the more that we can step back and the more that we can help them really achieve these intermediate mobility skills, the better orientation and mobility specialists we can become. And that's why I love the O&M Symposium so much and why I think it's been so successful. It's not because of me. It's really because we put you in the best position to be your favorite O&M self, not just your best O&M self, but your favorite version of your O&M self, and give you the tools that you need to help your learners succeed and skyrocket their skills in a way that allows you to go home on time. The whole deal isn't about doing more, being more, having to work harder, longer. No, it's about being better, being more impactful, connecting with your community, and learning from thought leaders from around the world so that way you can go home on time.
Welcome to A Step Forward, a podcast for ambitious VI specialists who are challenging the status quo. I'm Cassie Maloney, your new work bestie. With over 15 years of experience as an O&M specialist, author, professional development junkie, mom, and owner of Allied Independence, I have been through the ringer. And now I'm here to bring you a boost of inspiration, information, and our favorite, innovation, as we trade feeling overwhelmed for overjoyed while we create a significant impact in the lives of our learners and still lead more balanced, fulfilling lives. So grab your favorite beverage because we're about to take a step forward.
Welcome back to the podcast. You know, mobility is often the thing that we focus on the most in orientation and mobility, but we tend to stay at these very low levels of cane skills. And not that cane skills in and of themselves are low levels, but there's so much more to explore that we don't get enough time with in university courses. And really during our professional development, when we go to regional professional development and we're hearing from the same voices that typically speak up, we don't often get those skills there either, just because the people in our area may or may not be the experts in those subjects. And because those people have had the same experiences just about that we've had, and they have almost the same perspectives that we have, we often miss out on a lot of information that's going through the pipeline or that is being spread out, but we just aren't in the right room to receive it, and we don't spend enough time with that information. And for us as orientation and mobility specialists, you know, the profession is moving so fast that it can feel really difficult to stay on top of everything and know exactly who to pay attention to and know exactly what innovative strategies are coming down the pipe or what other people are doing. And we aren't the ones who suffer when that happens. It's really our clients. And that's the whole reason, the whole purpose of why I even got into helping to support you as an orientation and mobility specialist, is because I noticed that because I couldn't get the most innovative strategies, because I couldn't up level simply because of my own circumstances, because I couldn't leave my town, because of my own home personal life, not due to anything else, really, my students were the ones that were missing out. And that didn't feel fair. And moreover, my career had kind of stalled. You know, we're going to be orientation and mobility specialists for forever. There isn't really much upward mobility. So what we can do is strive to become better orientation and mobility specialists and become better at what we do and be able to have the confidence to teach those really intermediate or advanced skills. And cane skills can get us really far, but there's a lot to know about them. And there are a lot of other mobility skills that if we can bring them into our tool belt, then we can hand them off to our learners and say, here, this is in your tool belt as well. So I want to go over three intermediate mobility skills today that every O&M specialist needs to have in their back pocket. And even if what we do today is we just give you a little taste, a little tidbit about these skills, you'll be able to take them and start to work with them and start to have an understanding, because none of these things are really gone in depth in our university courses. And I had to learn all of them through other people, through the Orientation and Mobility Online Symposium. These episodes are turning out to be some of my favorite, the ones where we can take information from other people and share it with you, even if they're small clips. So that's what you'll hear today. I'll be talking quite a bit, and I've gone in to our archives and I've pulled out three really important pieces of information that even if you were at the symposium, that'll be really great for you to listen to and hear once again. So we've been talking about cane skills, so let's just start there with cane skills. Let me set the stage for you here for a second. My student and I were walking down the sidewalk, as we like to do, and he was using his cane and he had just become a cane user. The student at the time was a senior in high school, and in August of his senior year, he lost a lot of vision and he ran into something. And I didn't stop him, and his cane skills were new. They weren't at the point where he could catch it. And I remember in my mind thinking, oh, I'm so grateful. Why would I be so grateful for that? I was so grateful because I had prepared him for what was going to happen. Because if I'm not there, he's still going to run into stuff. I can't step in front of everything. But he was mentally prepared because he knew what phase of cane skills he was in. And he didn't expect perfection. But I didn't learn about these phases of cane skills until Donna talked about them a few years ago. And because I knew about them, because I was able to mentally prepare my learner for the fact that he was going to probably run into obstacles, and at about how many obstacles he was going to hit percentage-wise and about how many obstacles he was going to actually avoid percentage-wise based on where his cane skills were, he didn't take it to heart. He kept getting better. He didn't expect himself to be perfect. And most of all, he didn't throw away his cane to say, this doesn't work because obviously I ran into something. Because you're going to run into stuff. And that has to be okay when you're learning. So here's a clip from Donna Sauerberger sharing the four phases of cane proficiency from her presentation, Helping Students Become Proficient Cane Users.
If the students don't understand what is the purpose of that cane and the fact that they need to get to that fourth level of proficiency before it becomes useful, reliable, it may backfire and they may find out, oh, what's the point of this? It's not doing me any good, you know, because I still bump into poles. I still trip and fall, even though I'm, quote, using my cane. So it's very important that our students understand that. And also that we don't, as I said, link our success with how much the students use the cane, but rather than that they are achieving proficiency with the cane, whether they use it again or not, whether they ever use the cane, that our goal, we can get gratification from knowing that our student has reached that fourth level, not that, hey, my students all use the cane. What good is that if they haven't gotten to that fourth level? One of the people that Aaron surveyed, who had said the cane helped immensely, said that the instructor, quote, didn't force me to use a cane, but he taught me techniques and it made me comfortable using one. Another student said, suggested that we instructors ensure that the students know the skills, quote, even if they don't use it right then, they'll know how to use it in the future when they accept their disability. So there it is from your student's mouth, your students in the future reaching back to you and saying, don't worry about whether I use the cane. What's important is that I learn the skills, and whether I use it or not is not your goal as the instructor.
I don't know how it is now, but back in the day, we didn't spend that much time on guide dogs. If you were lucky, which I wasn't lucky during my internship, but during your internship, if you were lucky, you got to go to the guide dog school for a week and learn all about it. But if A, you somehow missed that boat, or B, you haven't been able to make time to go to a guide dog school, or C, it's just been a decade, okay? Like sometimes you've just been in the field for 10, 20, maybe 30 years and you haven't had a guide dog user. And then you get a learner who you think might be great for a guide dog, but it's been a few decades and you have other things in your brain at that point. Nobody is faulting you for that. Okay, my friend, it is allowed to happen. You're allowed to have other things put in your brain. You don't have to be the expert in every single area of orientation and mobility at all times. The guide dog usage is an intermediate mobility skill that we need to be able to teach at the exact moment that our learners need it. We don't have time to say, oh, hang on, let me go back for a week. Let me schedule that and let me go relearn how to do this. We don't have time for that. We can't just leave our lives for that amount of time. And oftentimes what ends up happening is we say, oh, I'm going to look this up during my planning period, and then you don't, yada, yada. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? But there are certain things that we want to look for when we're thinking about bringing our learners on that journey into a guide dog. A lot of times for me, it's been that the learner is the one who wants a guide dog, and I have to be the one to say, yeah, that's a great idea for you, or maybe not. And here's why. It's the maybe not ones that really you have to be able to stand your ground. You have to know exactly what you're talking about so that way you don't send them emotionally down a path. If you know that they're not going to qualify, or if you know that their school won't allow the dogs, or if you know that there are other obstacles, you're going to have to mentally prepare them for this. And not to say that they can't go reach for it, or you can't help them become that person who does qualify, but not every person with a visual impairment is going to qualify for a guide dog. I've had parents come to me and ask for their child to have a guide dog when the child was like 9, and this is a residential school. The parents don't even live here. And in those moments when I had this information, it was really great to be able to say, okay, here, this is what they're looking for. When your child qualifies for that, let's open up this conversation. But I've also had somebody who would be good for it and I wanted to run with it and I didn't have the skills and I didn't have the tools. So what ended up happening was we ended up taking a lot longer for them to even qualify because I wasn't 100% sure what he needed from me in order to bridge that gap. So here's some information about who qualifies for a guide dog.
Is your client an independent cane traveler, or do they only do the minimum amount of independent travel required to get from class to class, or are they motivated to develop independent routes to destinations? Orientation skills, can they maintain orientation only in familiar areas or also in unfamiliar areas? Can they remain oriented in open areas without the ability to follow a shoreline? And can they remain oriented in both indoor and outdoor environments? You want to look at their skills at analyzing traffic patterns. So is your client familiar with crossing at stop sign and stop light controlled intersections? And when approaching unfamiliar intersections, are they able to analyze them and make low risk crossing decisions? Functional vision is something you want to take a look at. So between guide dog schools, their vision requirements are going to vary a little bit in terms of what's considered acceptable to get into their program. But for us, vision loss must meet the federal standard for legal blindness, and the person must use a primary mobility aid to be considered for admission. Traveling in all types of weather conditions. This is especially important for people living in climates with long, harsh winters like we have in Michigan. Travel in all types of weather is required in class, but it's also important that a guide dog isn't taking 6 months off of the year in order to maintain those guiding skills that they develop during training. The emotional maturity and stability of a client's important. So our guide dog class is 3 weeks long, and we're bringing together people from all walks of life and from all over the US and Canada. So we want to know, are they able to function under stressful conditions and in a residential dormitory setting with shared meals, shared classes, and shared transportation? If they're diagnosed with a mental illness, is it under good control? And can they choose appropriate topics for conversation and groups of people with varying ages, demographics, and physical capabilities? Problem-solving skills, both guide dog class and just in the realities of life with a guide dog, you need to have the ability to stay calm and use independent problem-solving skills, because while the guide dog and the guide dog handler are in constant communication with each other, sometimes that can be a subtle communication. It takes some skill to interpret. It's worth asking, why do you want a guide dog? There are good reasons and bad reasons for wanting a guide dog. Some bad reasons we hear often are family and friends are pressuring people to get a guide dog. They think it'll fix all their problems. Some people think that it will make mobility easy or that it might compensate for their skill deficits. Some people just love dogs and they don't really understand that there's a difference between life with a guide dog as a mobility tool and life with a dog as a pet. We've had some doctors prescribe guide dogs. We'll get like a prescription for a guide dog, which of course is not how it works. There's also good reasons. A lot of people find that traveling with a guide dog sort of bridges a social gap and brings people toward the handler rather than feeling isolated, like some people report feeling when they're out traveling with their long cane. Increased efficiency in navigating around obstacles, or just a desire for that independence when transitioning through various stages of life. You want to talk to your client about cognitive and physical abilities. On the cognitive side, do they have the ability to remember when and how much to feed and water a dog, when it's time for a dog to be taken out to leash relief? Can they regulate and maintain a consistent schedule in their personal lives, whether they're in school or on summer break or on vacation? Do they have the ability to learn new skills and recognize and respond to an animal's needs? Looking at physical ability, stamina is a big one. During guide dog class, they are very long days with routes of at least 6 blocks that people are doing twice a day. You need arm strength to control a large young dog. Our GDMI team, our guide dog mobility instructors, they make the best matches possible, but all young dogs can pull on leash and they will challenge their handlers at times. So we don't want to put anyone at risk of a fall if a dog does start to be a little challenging. And then, of course, the ability to bend down and pick up after a dog. What sort of support will your client have from family, friends, school, work? Are they going to need financial assistance to care for a dog? Do they have an awareness of the lifestyle impact that bringing a guide dog into your life has? Are they willing to assist or just really take lead on teaching young siblings, young children, coworkers, family members, boundaries when it comes to interacting with their guide dog? And do they have someone in their support system that might be able to assist them with patterning the dog during transitions to new routes? So that could be maybe they get a new job and they have a new route to work, or starting college and developing routes there. Independent daily living skills are important. So we don't have a nurse on staff at Leader Dog. So our candidates must be able to administer their own medications. We don't have someone available to assist with that. Also, good hygiene. If you can't maintain your own physical appearance, hygiene and medications, would you be able to maintain the grooming and potential medical issues with a guide dog? There are some dogs out there that are trained to assist with activities of daily living, but our guide dogs are not. So anyone looking for that type of support would not be a good fit for our guide dog program. As you can see, this is a very long list of questions to think about, but really each one is just as critical as the one before it. We really want every person who's accepted into our guide dog program to be successful in class and for the entire working life of their guide dog. And these questions are a really important first step to assuring that. So I would encourage you to keep a copy of these at your desk or on your clipboard or in your car, wherever you have easy access to them. So when that conversation comes up, you are ready to have it with your clients.
So now that you know who qualifies for a guide dog, what does it take to prepare for one? Let's listen to this clip real quick.
So one of the best ways to prepare for a guide dog is to practice with human guide or Juno walk. And in case anyone isn't familiar with a Juno walk, this is when an instructor would essentially pretend to be the guide dog. These can get a little creative. A lot of times you can use an empty harness. You can use kind of like a folded up cane. Honestly, I've seen instructors get really creative with a Juno walk. But if you're interested in learning more about Juno walks, we do have a great video on our website under our resources tab where you can hear from our O&M team and how we conduct Juno walk. But anyways, so Juno walks or human guide are a great way to get started with a client. So one of the things that you can do is have the client provide directions on where to go and where to turn during the route. So meaning they are responsible for the orientation during the entire route. Make sure that the clients are confident in their decisions, because these orientation skills will be really beneficial when returning home for a guide dog. Also, having clients identify when they're approaching the curb or street to practice when they would begin giving the guide dog commands. So again, we're doing these either human guide or Juno walk. So we're having the client really communicate to us as the instructor, as they would the dog, basically. It's important to have the client, of course, analyzing the intersections and determining the appropriate time to cross. A good thing that you can do if a Juno walk, you know, you can have the client practice that forward command when it's the appropriate time to cross. Or if you're doing human guide, you can have the client kind of squeeze your arm when it's the appropriate time to cross. Another thing that you want to do is have practice guiding around obstacles, basically. So that's a very challenging thing sometimes for clients when switching from a cane to a guide dog, is following the lead of the guide dog. So a good way to practice that again is either human guide or Juno, and practice kind of weaving around obstacles and making sure that the client is naturally kind of following the dog's lead. That can be hard, especially for our clients with some remaining vision, to really kind of let go of that responsibility. So it's definitely something to practice. It's also a really great opportunity during human guide or Juno to be a quote unquote bad Juno. So for example, maybe you do blow past a curb and we want to recognize or have our client recognize, oh no, like something's not right. Or maybe you turn up the wrong driveway. All of these really great ideas, basically just simulating that problem solving, if you will. So you're maybe not being the most perfect guide dog. Of course, we want to talk about time and distance rate. Our clients should be using time distance rate to start anticipating when they should be approaching a curb or turn, to be able to give those commands to their guide dog with confidence. So recognizing, I probably should have been there by now and immediately start to problem solve to get back on track. And of course, non-tactile feedback. So we know when switching from a cane to a guide dog, we're losing all of that tactile information. So what are some other clues that we can use using traffic and other environmental sounds to determine when they're approaching a curb or other such details? So these skills when traveling with a guide dog and not having that tactile information all the time are going to be really helpful. Additionally, we're thinking again, our clients are going to be going into guide dog class, and then after that, they're going to have a guide dog coming home with them. These guide dogs, we often say a bored dog is a bad dog, meaning these dogs need to get out there. They're used to, when they're in training, getting out multiple times a day. So we want to encourage our clients to really build their stamina, get out, go on those multiple routes a couple times a day if they can, so that these dogs, when they get home, can still get out there and maintain their typical exercise, keeping them engaged and healthy. We also want to assist with developing routes. So we ask our clients to have a minimum of 3 established purposeful routes that can be traveled with a guide dog. You know, a lot of times we hear, oh, well, once I get a guide dog, then I'll get out and walk. That'll be my motivation. But not exactly how it works. Clients actually need to be motivated prior to getting the guide dog. We need to know that they actually have places that they travel independently. And so having purposeful route to the bank or to the grocery store or to a friend's house are going to be a little bit more motivational than maybe just an exercise walk around the block, which is still good. But again, having a little bit more motivation or purpose on those routes is going to be really helpful. Another thing we want to make sure that we're doing is referring our clients to other professionals. So if we're noticing potentially a hearing loss on one ear or both ears, or they're having difficulty building that stamina, maybe there's a gait problem or a balance issue, we want to make sure that we're referring to these other professionals. It's a really good idea to get those things sorted out prior to coming for a guide dog, especially, you know, thinking about hearing. It's really going to be important that they have that all squared away and they're ready to come and be successful when getting a guide dog. And of course, we also want to help our clients advocate and educate others that are going to be around this guide dog. It's really kind of a whole community involvement, if you will, especially in those smaller communities where everybody knows everybody. We want to make sure that people understand how to respect our handlers and their guide dog prior to getting the guide dog and or client in those situations. So if that's a younger client going back to a school, maybe there's an assembly or at least a meeting with the school officials and teachers to know what the expectations are for the student and for the guide dog. It's really important that, as Chrissy mentioned, siblings and family members understand that it's the client's responsibility to take care of the dog and meet all of the dog's needs. So making sure that we're just helping our client advocate and educate others so that they can be successful when returning home for a guide dog.
Now, I have to thank Leader Dogs for coming on to the Orientation and Mobility Online Symposium and sharing that information and helping us become better O&M specialists so that way we could bridge that gap no matter what school your learners decide to go to for their guide dog. It can be really helpful just to have that information. So if you do have somebody looking to be a guide dog user, make sure you bookmark this episode or at least take notes and put them somewhere where you'll be able to search them. And last but not least, there's a way of teaching mobility skills and orientation in general that I don't think is talked about enough in the school setting. I was fortunate enough to go through my university program as that was the way that was being taught. But because it was less structured than what I teach my learners, I then had a difficult time bridging that gap. And that's to nobody's fault of their own. Everybody has gap or 2 or 10 or 10 million that they have to bridge between university and actually becoming a good teacher. So if you're in that place and you're new, know that it is normal. There's no way that anybody leaves any university program fully equipped to handle everything in the real world. But this was an area for me that I had to figure out in my own brain how to take this information and then break it down for my learners, because I was taught with structured discovery. But structured discovery as an adult under blindfold, adventitiously, quote unquote, blinded, that's much different than how we teach our young ones. And what ended up happening for me was I found this great middle area and and I can slide down into actually more structured of this is how you do it step by step to the actual structured discovery model for my older individuals. And that has less structure, actually, much less actual structure. That one is much more like, let's figure it out. I'm going to just ask you questions and I will help guide your thinking as opposed to guide your process. Dr. Edward Bell is the director of the Professional Development and Research Institute on Blindness at Louisiana Tech University. He heads the NOMC program there and has a visual impairment himself, if you don't know. Having him to share about his experiences on how he came to accept blindness within himself was absolutely profound. Let's take a listen to this clip of Dr. Bell sharing his story of how he finally started to accept his visual impairment.
My cane travel instructor was this relatively young woman who, you know, introduced herself to me, and I already had my cane. And at this training center, if you had any usable vision at all, you had to wear the sleep shade or the blindfold. And but I didn't have any vision, so I didn't have to use the blindfolds. And so she took me out of her office and we went in the hallway. And she's really now, I mean, so I've had a cane now for 6 months, but I don't really know how to use it. All I know is put it out there in front of you and stop walking if it hits something. So she starts really working with me on, you know, the two touch technique and arcing the cane. And she's standing at one end of the hallway and I'm going up down the hallway and she's correcting me, you know, your arc is too wide or too high. Lower that down a little bit. And I thought, okay, well, fine. So we spent some time doing that. And I don't remember if it was that day or maybe it was the next day or a couple of days later, she said, all right, you got your cane technique down. Okay, let's go ahead and go outside. And we're just going to, you know, we're going to cross some streets. We're just going to go for a walk. This is not anything independent. We're just really working on your cane skills and techniques. So we go out to the main road and turn down the sidewalk and start going. And sure enough, I'm able to detect the drop-offs, the curbs. And we crossed the street and went several blocks and turned a corner and kept going. And then so she asked me, you know, so tell me about your blindness. Because that wasn't the first thing we spent the first day doing. We just jumped right into it and started doing the cane immediately. And so by this point, I had gotten really good at my pity party and talking about the dramatic shooting. And any of you around the world, if you don't know what a shotgun is, it's a plastic shell that holds hundreds of these small metal BBs or pellets. And so when it sprays out, it basically hits you like a spray of mist. And I still had all these shrapnel embedded in my scalp, in my head. And so I'm telling her the dramatic story of being shot down and the blood and the woe is me. And I remember she kind of looked at me and she said, so you still have all this metal in your head? And I said, yes. And she said, well, so if I shake your head, will it rattle? And I was like, whoa, that was pretty insensitive. And she kind of laughed and she said, look, you know, I'm sorry for what happened to you. It sounds like a tragedy, but the pity party has gotten you as far as it's going to get you. Where is it going to get you from here? It's not going to get you to the place where you want to be. She said, blindness can be the worst thing that ever happened to you. It could be another thing that happened to you. There are lots of good and bad things that happen to you, and this doesn't have to be the end of your life. And we kept walking in, and I said, but you don't understand. I can't see anything. I wanted to go into the military. I wanted to travel the world. I wanted to, you know, see things. And she said, well, you know, I've been to probably 20 different states myself, and I've been to Europe twice, and I'm blind. And I thought, Europe twice? Wow, that's crazy. And then I thought, you're blind? What do you mean you're blind? I don't know whether she had mentioned it to me or not, but she was so smooth with her cane and so fluid and stuff. It never occurred to me that she was as blind as I was. And so then I panicked and said, how are we going to find our way back to the training center? Well, that was a silly thing that she just laughed off. And we made it back to the training center, of course, with no incidences or anything. But it had a real lasting impact, both the message that pity and sorrow for yourself may be warranted when something first happens, but it's not going to ultimately get you to the place you want to be. And so how do you get past that and start moving on with your life? And the other thing was this, again, this notion that there are lots of blind people out there living normal lives and doing things, and you can have that too.
At Louisiana Tech, they teach structured discovery, and many NOMC programs also teach in the structured discovery method. And to me, it's a much more comprehensive method than a task analysis and breaking it down and scaffolding like we teach with our younger ones. I think both have major value, but structured discovery is more complex because you're not breaking down the full process for the learner and teaching it to them. You're not necessarily forward chaining and backward chaining everything and scaffolding it all. You are allowing them to live in their playground and you are simply the guide. You're not necessarily the one teaching them all of the things to think. You're teaching them how to think for themselves. That's how I think about it. But let's get into what structured discovery really is. Structured discovery is a unique instructional service that is used to teach independence to individuals who are blind in a meaningful, robust, and lifelong manner. Structured discovery instructional services consist of non-visual techniques, problem-solving strategies, experiential learning, and confidence-building experiences. Structured discovery relies heavily on Socratic questioning, not just teaching them, but asking the right questions to guide the learner in solving the problem. It also relies on role modeling of non-visual techniques, which demonstrates their effectiveness while correcting misconceptions about blindness. These teaching strategies are used across all adjustment categories, including cane travel, braille literacy, home management training, computer and access technology, woodshop, and seminars and other activities which focus on coping with visual impairments and confronting attitudes about blindness. Structured discovery, therefore, describes a unique rehabilitation teaching service substantially and recognizably different from conventionally or traditional approaches of teaching individuals who are blind and visually impaired. And these strategies include non-visual skills, problem solving, personal attitudes, public misconceptions, and giving back. That information came from NBPCB, and I will link the whole document and website in the show notes. So that way, if you're interested in structured discovery, you can go read more about it. If you're not familiar with how to use Socratic questioning within your classes, I highly suggest learning about it and starting to implement these ways. I'm sure you already do a lot of it. It's very, very, very similar to what we do. It's just that it's much less structured, much less scaffolded, like I said. But here's Edward sharing how structured discovery came to be.
Structured discovery is born out of the lived experiences of men and women, blind men and women, who grew up through the National Federation of the Blind. What that means is this, that any of you guys who graduated from an O&M program, you know that there was no profession of O&M before the 1940s. There certainly were blind people around, but they didn't have any training. They pretty much figured it out by hook or by crook, or they sat at home and sat in a rocking chair and didn't do anything with their lives. So not until 1942 did Richard Hoover begin what we know of today as orientation mobility. I'm not going to repeat that lecture. You all got it in your universities. Something else happened around that same time too, though, and that is in 1940, the National Federation of the Blind was founded, and its original model was security, equality, and opportunity. In other words, it was blind men and women who came together for the express purpose of trying to make lives better for themselves and for the future generations, to get access to opportunities, to have financial securities, to be able to live the lives that they want. The members of the NFB really believed that given proper training and some opportunity, the average blind person can do the average job just as well as any sighted person can. And so it's that core philosophy that really served as the generation of what this model had started off with and has evolved into.
So let's wrap up. Three intermediate mobility skills that every O&M specialist must have. We've got an understanding of the four phases of cane skills, for one. Our learners need to understand that if they are brand new cane users, they are not going to be proficient at this. We also, as O&M specialists, need to understand when it's okay to work on the O, when we want to work on the M, when we want to combine them. And those four phases will tell us exactly what we need to teach and at what time. Then we also talked about guide dog usage. Your learner's gonna need their cane skills in order to have a guide dog. This is a very important skill that we have to keep in our back pockets at all times, but we really just need the foundation. We really just need to know a little bit and where to go get that information once our learners demonstrate that they really are gonna be good candidates. And then the third one was about structure discovery. If you're used to teaching in the traditional model, I highly suggest researching structure discovery and starting to implement more questions, starting to back off a little bit more than you already have, and starting to allow your learners to get lost a little bit more. There's no better feeling than getting yourself out of a parking lot using structured discovery, because there's no real way to get out of a big open space using that format of teaching. That is just like step by step by step by step by step. Do this, do this, do this, do this. It doesn't exist. You're teaching your learners not just what to do, but how to think, what questions to ask themselves. And if you can then combine the traditional methods and the structured discovery method of teaching, even for younger ones, it allows them to overcome their misconceptions about their blindness or visual impairment. And it allows them to step more fully into who they truly are. And I think it also goes back to Robin Clark at the TVI Symposium this past year was talking about how we often have teacher-centered lessons. And really, we just need to back up, just keep backing up, back up, back up, back up, back up even more. And I will tell you, I've been working on this. It is so uncomfortable. And I just feel like I'm doing nothing. And I'm just like sitting there. And I am. But that's the point, right? Like, if I'm the one doing it all, my learners will happily give me their phone and let me look up something. They're not going to take it back from me. They will happily like, oh, here, look this up. Tell me what I need to do. And the more that we can step back and the more that we can help them really achieve these intermediate mobility skills, the better orientation and mobility specialists we can become. And that's why I love the O&M Symposium so much and why I think it's been so successful. It's not because of me. It's really because we put you in the best position to be your favorite O&M self, not just your best O&M self, but your favorite version of your O&M self, and give you the tools that you need to help your learners succeed and skyrocket their skills in a way that allows you to go home on time. The whole deal isn't about doing more, being more, having to work harder, longer. No, it's about being better, being more impactful, connecting with your community, and learning from thought leaders from around the world, so that way you can go home on time, spend time with your kitten, spend time in your garden, spend time with your loved one, go out in nature, go do things that fill your cup. Because if you keep running on E and thinking that that's going to get you the recognition that you so desperately want and desire, either from yourself or from outside, it's not. Take it from somebody who lived in burnout for so long. I went through multiple cycles of burnout, and I strived so hard to be the O&M specialist that got recognized at staff meetings, that got recognized from other people, and I wasn't. Part of that is because I have a much softer personality. Part of that is because I'm much more understanding than other people. But a lot of it was because energetically, I was burnt out for a good majority of my full-time career because I didn't have these skills, because I wasn't going home on time. I wasn't cultivating a healthy life outside of work. And so my cup was not full. So I would show up every day with like little drops that I could give and a leaky cup. So of course I wasn't being as impactful as I wanted to be. I didn't show up to this career to not be impactful. I showed up to make a difference, as did you, and as do you. We opened early bird registration for the O&M Symposium a few weeks ago, and we had over 300 people register in a week. Ah, oh my gosh, right? Like, ah, I love you all. And I think that speaks to two different things. One, you. You guys are the ones doing it. You're moving our profession forward. You're the ones who stepped up and put in your presentation applications. You guys are the ones who decided on which presentations you wanted to see. And then you guys are the ones who said, yep, without even an agenda out. You said, I want that. And you went for it. And there's no better feeling than knowing that we as a community can make change in our field. Regular registration is currently open. That is so exciting. And it'll be open till, I believe, January 18th. So you can go to orientationandmobilitysymposium.com to get more information about it and to register. But if you want to get on our email list, go to alliedindependenceonline.com and click the links that offer free lesson plans. Yes, yes, we give away free lesson plans. We're all about making your life easier here. And then you'll get free lesson plans and you'll be on our email list. Or just follow me on social at Allied Independence, where we have been sharing more information from the other people who have taught at our symposiums before. All right, friends, I cannot wait to continue this conversation next week. Until then, I hope that you can take this information to help you take a step forward.
Impactful VI specialists are changing the way that we do things. The old way is no longer acceptable, and we get to decide how we're going to make more impact without burning ourselves out. I'm so grateful that you've taken the time to listen to this podcast. I would love it if you would leave a review on Apple Podcasts, or if you even just came and hung out with us on social media. I'm at Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. You can find me at Allied Independence. I'd love to hear from you in my DMs. Let me know how you liked this episode and anything that you took away from it. Until next week, just remember that all you have to do is take a step forward.